And now I'll start talking. So the talk today is based on quite a famous sutta, actually called the Simile of the Cloth. And this is from the Majjhima Nikaya, as I've mentioned in the past. And this is actually sutta number 7 in that collection of teachings of the Buddha. And I want to start just by reading the first, just the second verse, actually. And what I'm going to do tonight, instead of reading the entire thing, I'm going to sort of read pieces and talk about it and read some more pieces. And we'll gradually work our way through the whole sutta that way. But this is the first and probably one of the most famous of the Buddha's suttas, this particular verse. Excuse me. Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Bhikkhus, suppose the cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether red, blue, or yellow, or carmine. It would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. So first of all, I want to point out that this is very classic Buddhist teaching, in the sense that the Buddha is using very common imagery that everybody in the agrarian economy that he was part of would understand right away. Everybody weaved cloth and dyed cloth. It was just like part of life. So they would understand this image quite clearly right away. And basically, what he's saying is that this practice is about purification. And in fact, in the Satipatthana Sutta, right at the very beginning, before the Buddha gives any teaching at all about meditation or anything like that, he says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. I mean, this is how he starts when he teaches meditation. So he's making it very clear what this is all about. So basically the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, teach us how to purify ourselves. Otherwise, practicing is like having a dirty cloth and trying to dye it. But we have to be very careful here, because if we're not careful, this sort of idea very quickly becomes a very efficient way to beat ourselves up in yet another way. Oh, look, here's a great Buddhist way to beat myself up, right? To blame myself, to think poorly of myself. And that's not the intent here at all. It's just to point out that, and it's not like the Buddha is saying we're all bad people or naughty people or anything like that. He's saying, and what he's really talking about, the impurities he's talking about are impurities of mind. The impurities that of what arises in our mind that we deal with very unskillfully, or we don't deal with them at all. They just run riot. And it's those impurities that he's primarily concerned with. And basically, what the teachings say is, wherever we are in life right now, where we start where we are now, and gradually, and I want to keep emphasizing this all through this talk, gradually, over time, we purify ourselves a little more and a little more and a little more. This isn't like an on-off switch. This is a process. As I mentioned last week, this whole practice is a process. And then, being the Buddha, of course, he has to make sure you understand what he means by impurities. So then verse 3 says, what, bhikkhus, are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. He's trying to make sure we understand. But notice these are all how the mind is defiled. This isn't about, you know, being pure in the wagging finger sense. You know, this is about the state of our mind. And then he goes on to say, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Knowing that ill will, and he goes through the whole list again, a bhikkhu abandons it. And I mentioned this word abandon before, but before I do that, I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's. This is a great book. This is one of his early books called Insight Meditation. So this is, I think, from the 80s. So I think this is like the second book he ever put out. And he speaks very eloquently about what I was talking about a little bit earlier. The first thing you might remind yourself in times of difficulty is the fact that you've already accumulated great powers of purity and liberation in your mind. That truth may be hard to remember or to believe in the midst of some mental storm of fear, anger, intense craving, or whatever, but it is true. Otherwise, you would not be here as a human being. This precious human birth is the certain result of our own past wholesome actions. And the fact that we've been drawn to practice the path of awakening indicates even stronger forces of purity within us. His Holiness Dinko Kentse Rinpoche, one of the great Tibetan masters of this century, wrote, "Ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants of this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born as a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dharma? How many of those who start continue? Reflecting in this way on our own interest in the Dharma creates feelings of joy and confidence." This is a great thing to remember, especially in those times when you're struggling. It's like, wow, I actually am one of those people who actually connected to this stuff. Lucky me, number one, lucky me. But also it's like, it indicates that there was something, I was drawn to this somehow in this life that was very powerful. The flip side of this, however, is you have to be very careful not to go, and aren't I great? I'm one of those chosen people who have found the Dharma. You know, it's like very easy to go there too. And that's also very unwholesome. It's just, whew, lucky me. That's plenty. Yeah. Okay. And then I want to talk a little bit more about abandoning. So, I read a definition of abandon last week. Here's yet two more different definitions of the word abandon, which is what the Buddha, that's a term the Buddha uses a lot when he talks about impurities, abandoning them. To leave completely and finally forsake utterly or desert, or to give up, discontinue, and withdraw from. So this implies a very powerful stepping back, a conscious, and there's the key, a conscious choice to step back, to not get caught by these impurities of mind. That's why mindfulness is so important, because mindfulness is what allows us to see these unwholesome mind states arising in the first place. Without mindfulness, the mind just runs on its own volition, one habit to the next, to the next, to the next. But with mindfulness, we start to go, oh, look at that. Anger has arisen, or fear has arisen, or lust has arisen, or whatever your favorite defilement is, for that matter. It's just, that's what happens. But now with mindfulness, we start to actually see them. This gives rise to right understanding and right intention. We see them clearly, and then we form the intention to do something about it. So this is how, we understand that our cloth, which is the image of us, our mind is the cloth, is kind of dirty. It has these impurities, and we're going to have to clean out those impurities to be purely dyed, to really shine when we're dyed. And that's just the way things are. Then the Buddha goes on. And this is, I'm going to read several verses here. When a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when a bhikkhu has known that ill will, and it goes through the list again, he abandons it. The Blessed One, he acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha thus. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and human, enlightened and blessed. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutations, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind, he considers thus, I am possessed of unwavering confidence in the Buddha, and he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. So, what he's talking about here is taking refuge. Let's look at what he's talking about. He's talking about taking, you know, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Those were the three things. Well, what do we chant when I chant at the beginning? When I chant the three refuges, I'm chanting, I'm taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So once we have right understanding and right intention, what the Buddha is saying is, then you have to take refuge. That's why in this tradition, the very first thing we do every time we teach, every time we practice in a group, is we chant the refuges. We remind ourselves how important refuge is. It's like where it's what we have to do first. But what does this mean? What does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha? What actually is the meaning of that idea? What's the idea behind it? Well, by the Buddha, we can mean several things. If we were culturally Buddhist, if we'd grown up in a Buddhist society, if we'd grown up in Myanmar or Sri Lanka or Cambodia, Thailand, and we sort of grew up in a world that was, by its nature, Buddhist, would have a particular understanding of what the Buddha meant. You know, our family shrine would have a statue of the Buddha in it, or a picture of the Buddha. You know, so we have this idea, this idealized idea of what the Buddha is. But I suspect that most, or even all of us here, probably didn't grow up in Buddhist families. We grew up in a traditional Western family and in the Abrahamic tradition of some sort. So for us, there's not that cultural understanding. Then what does it mean for us? this idea. And basically here, what we're taking refuge in is almost like the idea of the Buddha. Here's this person who 2,600 years ago practiced in the way as he had later described it and reached enlightenment through his own efforts. And then he went on to teach what he'd learned. He's sort of an example of what's possible for all of us. So we're taking refuge in that historical figure who we revere, might perhaps be the right word, because of what he accomplished. And here it is 2,600 years later, and it's still going on. So that's how powerful, whatever he did was pretty powerful. Or, and here's another thought. Basically, one thing the Buddha said many, many times is that we all have what's called, we'll call Buddha nature, bodhicitta. We all have inherent within us the capability of being a Buddha, of becoming enlightened. And that, for me, is the thing that I hold most strongly when I think of taking refuge in the Buddha. I'm taking refuge in that possibility that the Buddha told me existed, over and over again told me existed. The fact that I have Buddha nature, that within my own life I can do something about this. This wasn't something that came easily to the Buddha. I want to actually read a few other sections from the Majjhima Nikaya here. And this is from Sutta 26. And in this sutta, the Buddha is describing what happened to him. It's sort of one of those things where someone said, "And how did you get here?" And he sort of told his whole life history in terms of practice. And now he's talking about he's become enlightened, and he's sitting there going, "Now what do I do?" Basically, now what? This is his original thoughts. "I considered this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment." Could be talking about right now, right? "It's hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. It is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me." Thereupon, and he thought, "Well, maybe I should just go retire to the forest and meditate for the rest of my life." But luckily, verse 20 says, "Then bhikkhus, the Brahma Samapatti, knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, declines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Samapatti vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and extending his hands in reverential salutation towards me, he said, 'Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma.'" So basically, this Brahma, this celestial being, came along and talked the Buddha into teaching, essentially. And So we have to consider that perhaps we just have some dust in our eyes. I definitely have some dust in my eyes. I don't know about you guys. I'll speak for myself. I definitely have some dust in my eyes. And I'm trying to wash it out. Trying to let the Dhamma wash it out. Get a clear. So taking refuge in the Buddha is in a sense an act of faith. It's faith in the Buddha himself, faith that he reached enlightenment, and faith that we have in our own potential to reach enlightenment. That's what I have to, when I take refuge in the Buddha, I'm taking refuge in that faith. This is where faith arises in the Buddha's teachings, right here. It's not blind faith. It's faith given that we saw what was happening. And remember that it's faith that I'm taking faith only in the potential. No magic involved. Just having faith is just the very beginning of the whole thing. So by the Dhamma, by taking refuge in the Dhamma, they were talking primarily what this means is taking refuge in the teachings of the Buddha, the record that has come down through the ages on what the Buddha taught. And you have to remember that like this sutta I'm reading wasn't written down contemporaneously. I mean, it wasn't written down as the Buddha was speaking, someone was scribbling. In the beginning, all of the Buddhist teachings were oral. People, the Sangha, the monks and nuns, it was their job, part of their job as monks and nuns, part of their duty, was to memorize parts of the entire Dhamma. And then recite them as when, the monks and nuns would all get together, particularly after the Buddha had passed. They'd get together and they'd take turns reciting their part of the Dhamma and maybe talking about it a little bit, expounding on it. And teaching the younger monks and nuns their part so that someone would always be around to remember that part. And then a couple of hundred years after the Buddha passed, but at this point, Buddhism had spread all through North India, like literally all through North India, which is a huge space, and had become a Buddhist kingdom. And the king, very powerful king, said, "All right, let's get all these monks together and write this all down. We can't let this just be oral. We have to actually write it all down." And literally for years, monks and nuns came and recited their part, and it got written down until all of the Dhamma was recorded. So the Dhamma is in essence, if you can think of it as like this really detailed map of how to get to enlightenment. And it has lots of different routes. If you look at the Dhamma and start studying it, before long you see, oh, there's this way and there's that way. There's lots of different approaches and different ideas. And you can pick your route through the map. But that takes effort, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing right now, as a matter of fact, teaching the Dhamma, trying to get you to study the Dhamma. So in a sense, taking refuge in the Dhamma is a recommitment to study, a commitment to actually not just listen to the Dhamma, though listening to the Dhamma talks is a powerful way to study. It's the beginning for some of us more fanatical studiers, perhaps. It's like, let's really dig into this and really get to understand it more. So taking refuge in the Dhamma isn't passive. This is an active effort that we take. And then, so that's taking refuge in the Dhamma. Then there's taking refuge in the Sangha. What does that mean? Well, it's one of those words, the Sangha has several different meanings. One is all those over the last 2,600 years who, following the Buddha's teachings, have become enlightened. Thousands, hundreds of thousands, who knows? I mean, it's like an enormous number of people have become enlightened. And to this day, there are beings in the world right now who are enlightened from following the Buddha's teachings. So this is not like just something that happened back then. This is something that's an ongoing, continuous process. And I find that kind of encouraging. It's like, oh, it wasn't just this one guy who did this 2,600 years ago, and we have to sort of believe what he said and have faith in him. No, it's like this is an ongoing active thing that's happening right now, and it's possible, and people have done this through all those 2,600 years. It has never ended. You know, and who knows who all those people are? I don't. I mean, I have this idea, and this is going to shock some of you, being I grew up in a very Christian family, and I realized after a while that, you know, in the Bible there's this time where, you know, Jesus is 12 and all of a sudden he's 30. What happened in those 18 years? And I think he went to India and studied with Buddhist teachers. If you look at a lot of the Christian teachings, with the original teachings of Christ, they're very Buddhist in nature. And I think Christ was an enlightened being who taught. There's just one example that I think of. And you can think of your own, you know, whoever appeals to you, Mother Teresa, perhaps. Yeah. So that's one idea of the Sangha. And the very first time the Buddha taught, and I have to turn to another section of the sutta here. The very first time, this celestial being came down, and the Buddha said, yeah, okay, I'm going to teach. And then his question was, well, now what do I do? Who am I going to go teach? And he originally studied with two great concentration masters. When in his first periods of training, after he ran away from home, he spent time with two different great concentration masters. And he said, they had a little dust in their eyes, they'd be perfect. But then through his celestial powers, he realized they were both dead. They were gone. So I couldn't go teach them. Oops. And then he remembered these five guys he used to hang out in the forest with, this was in the period where he was into this whole thing about being very austere, you know, living on one grain of rice a day and nettle soup, and then just like really roughing it, you know, and he eventually gave that up and luckily found the middle way. But he thought, those guys, they were, I'll go find them. Because, yeah, I know this time of year they'll be hanging out in this place in this forest. So he spends several days walking there, and he comes and he finds these guys. And first when they see him, it's like, oh, it's that, you know, backslider Gautama. You know, the guy who gave up on our austere practices, you know. Look how plump he looks, you know. It's like, but as he got closer to them, they realized, see, there's something different about this guy. And they said, who are you? And he said, I'm the one who no longer suffers. That was how we introduced themselves. I'm the one who no longer suffers. And they said, how do you do that, basically? And he taught them. And then here's what happened after he taught them. Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. In other words, they all became enlightened. He taught, they heard the Dhamma, they became enlightened. Very first time he taught. And then all through the suttas, all through the next 40 years of teaching, the suttas are full of stories of so-and-so, some Brahmin or someone came and asked some questions and the Buddha taught him and he became enlightened. It's just like, it goes on and on and on. So, and then who knows what happened after that? Well, it's another 2,600 years of practice. So there's got to be a lot of people out there. The Sangha can have other meanings as well. It could mean all the people who are practicing right now in the world. I mean, right now, here we are practicing. There's hundreds, thousands, who knows how many other people, how many other sanghas, groups like this are meeting right now, gathering together to teach and practice. Unlimited. Who knows? Or it could be those people who are I'm practicing with right now. Right now I'm practicing. These people I'm practicing with, this is my Sangha right now. We have gathered together and created a collective energy that is much more powerful than any one single one of us. And it's that collective energy of Sangha that makes what we're doing possible. Or and it could be those people I practice with regularly, you know, my Tuesday night Sangha people. I go to the Tuesday night sitting group, and so it's my Tuesday night Sangha. So that's another way of thinking about it. So there's lots of different ideas about how you might think about this. But when you think about it, what we're talking about here, taking refuge in the Sangha, is taking refuge in love. The love I feel just sitting here right now coming from you, and that goes from me back to you. That's what taking refuge in the Sangha is. So by taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we're taking refuge really in faith, effort, and love. So it's like the three-legged stool that supports the entire practice. Without those three, without faith, effort, and love, what we're doing isn't possible. So when we take refuge, we're taking refuge in that energy. And think about what would happen if one of those three wasn't there. So what if we had faith and we made effort to study, but there was no love? That heart connection wasn't there. What would end up with is fundamentalism, fanaticism, extremism of some sort. All you got to do is look around the world and you can see people who are holy, who really studied their particular book, whether it's the Bible or the Quran or the Majjhima Nikaya for that matter, and become fanatics because they have the only right answer, because they've lost that connection to the heart and that connection through the heart to everyone. And it's just people who believe what I believe, they're the only ones that count. So that doesn't work. So what happens if we have just faith and love, but we don't make any understand or practice the teachings? Then this heads towards what I'll call flower children. Having been one, I'm allowed to say that. Okay. This was the problem with the hippies, is that we're full of love. Everything's love and peace and all that. Love solves all everything. Love. It was great. Beautiful, so peaceful. All you need is love. But we weren't grounded in our practice. We didn't have effort in actually understanding the teachings. And that just leads to fairyland over and over and over again. And it's going on right out there today. I mean, And then, well, what if we have knowledge and love but no faith? We've studied, our heart's full, but we don't have faith in a particular teaching. Then we end up with what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. This idea that it's all okay, man. I can do take a little bit of this and a little bit of that and mix it all together and come up with my own thing and it'll be cool. That's not how it works. We have to actually study a particular form of the teachings. And I'm not saying at all that it should be this form, what I'm teaching. It doesn't matter. But we have to take one thing and take it seriously and go deep, deep, deep into that study. Then we don't get caught by the idea of spiritual materialism. Okay, so I want to go back to the sutta here. If I can find my page. So here he's talking about what happens to the mind. He says, he has gained inspiration in the meaning, given inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When he is glad, the mind becomes concentrated. So once we've taken refuge, then the Buddha says, now we have to have a concentrated mind. That's the next step. And he considers thus, the imperfections of the mind have been part being given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected to the Dhamma. The key words I want to point out there are that he says, basically, that in part has been given up. This is the Buddha saying, this is the process. This isn't like an on-off switch. And I said this before, right? I want to keep coming back to this because it's so important. It's like, this is the process where slowly but surely, we purify that cloth of our mind. It's like step by step by step. It isn't all at once. And so it's okay to be basically given up in part, to see that there's something happening here. It seems better. I'm still got lots of work to do. That's a fine place to come from. Don't think you have to be perfect. Think that it's not about the end. It's about the process and it's about the intention. You know, the Buddha talked a lot about intention. This is the intention to purify that's important, not the fact that you're pure. That'll come with time, with practice. Right now, let's pay real strong attention to intention. That idea that I'm going to move in that direction. Then the next section. He goes on describing the mind state of one who is now concentrated and has moved towards perfection. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with the mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. First of all, I love these words, abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. It's not just a little bit. This is like a lot. This is the mind is filled with loving kindness. And then he uses exactly the same words to talk about compassion, sympathetic joy, joy that we experience when we see others joyful, and equanimity. The four, these are called the Brahma Viharas, the noble abodes. This is this exact language you'll see in many, many suttas. This is basically the next stage where we start to have a mind not filled with unwholesomeness, but filled with these really wholesome thoughts. loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These are all wholesome mind states. And gradually over time, those mind states pervade. And in the Theravadin tradition, these are all things that we can practice as well. There are actual formal meditation practices that do with all four of the Brahma Viharas. That at some point, probably in the fall, I'm going to spend some time teaching Brahma Vihara practice as opposed to this form of practice. But I don't want to say anything more except it's interesting that that's the progression. We progress from having a mind that's full of impurity to a mind full of wholesome thoughts. And the wholesome thoughts that the Buddha says, here's the ones we really want: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Those are the wholesome mind states we want to encourage, we want to move towards. Another interesting thing to note about these four Brahma Viharas, if you're actually from a Mahayana tradition or even some of the Vajrayana traditions where the idea of bodhisattva and taking bodhisattva vows is so strong, part of all bodhisattva vows is to take vows to cultivate the four Brahma Viharas. They might be called the four immeasurables or the four jewels in some traditions. But all bodhisattva vows contain the Brahma Viharas embedded right in those vows as something that we choose to cultivate. So then, after we've taken a look at the Brahma Viharas, then Buddha starts talking about now what? He understands thus, there's this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond, there is the escape from this whole field of perception. What's this about? Oh, I'll read this line again. He understands thus, there's this, there's the inferior, there's the superior, and beyond, there's an escape from this whole field of perception. The inferior and the superior, relative reality, absolute reality. This is another theme that occurs over and over and over again in Buddhist teachings, where we have to acknowledge that we live in relative reality. We live in the world of me, not me, this, not this. But the practice leads us to a deeper and deeper experience of absolute reality until we even transcend the world of perception. And then, when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life is being lived. What had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. That's liberation. That's enlightenment. That's what he's describing here. It's something that you know. At some point, it's clear you know. And then he goes on, and this is sort of interesting. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin Sundarika was sitting not far from the Blessed One. Then he said to the Blessed One, how does Master Gautama go to the Bahuka River to bathe? Why, Brahmin, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? And then this conversation, this is like a traditional Brahmin practice of going to holy rivers and bathing. When I actually traveled in India with an Indian teacher, at one point we actually hiked up to the very source of the Ganges, which is way high up, 15,000 feet in the Himalayas in a valley. And the Ganges comes roaring out of this ice cave. So the water's like, there's chunks of ice in the water. And the thing to do is to bathe in that water. It's like very purifying. It was also really cold, let me tell you. But it was like traditional thing you do. So that was, and what the Buddha is saying, no, you don't need to bathe in these rivers, because you've been bathed with the inner bathing. It's the inner bathing that's important. Going to these rivers, bathing in these rivers is like, yeah, nice. Maybe get clean, have a good adventure. But it's the inner bathing that's important. It's not the holy river that cleans you. It's you. It's your effort, your practice. You're taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And then at the very end, this Brahmin who he's been talking to all along, he says, and the Brahmin Sundarika received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the venerable Brahmin, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life. So the Buddha taught, this Brahmin took the teaching to heart. He went off and practiced on his own, you know, diligent and ardent, and became an enlightened being. So this here's another person becoming an enlightened being in the suttas. Like I said, it's everywhere. So hearing the Dhamma, one way to think of this is that hearing the Dhamma is a source of liberation energy. Like actually just hearing the Dhamma gladdens our heart, fills us with studying the Dhamma, fills our heart, gladdens our heart, fills us with energy to practice. That's why I think it's so important that we actually hear the Dhamma and the Dhamma as it actually is written. Remember what we're doing. And this is a note I actually wrote to myself here. Right? Remember that this is what we're doing is heading towards enlightenment. This is why we practice. Don't get discouraged about nothing happening. The process is what is important now. The end point will come in its own time. It's all about practice, 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 the process itself. And speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that over time, somehow, if I look back on my 40 odd years of practice, it really does change you. It really does make a difference. And if that gives you a little glimpse of faith, good. I'm only speaking from personal experience here. I want to finish by reading, as always, a poem. This is once again from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. This poem is called Enough. Excuse me for a second here. It's enough to offer love, no matter how imperfectly received or given. It's enough to try and fail at a difficult task. Enough to fall and rise, stumble, fall again, sigh, and start to walk, however slowly, in the direction the soul points. It's enough to seek peace and find pain, to gain nothing but a vision of truth and take the long route home. It's enough to feel temptation, the dance of the senses, the hot pull of desire, enough to call on God, walk through fire, sleep and cry in fear, or welcome dying. It's enough to be and breathe, to feel the touch of wind on skin. It's enough to take the day as it comes, to watch the ripples on the lake as the rock sinks to the bottom, to see the wild reflection on the surface calm into a mirror once again. It's enough to hear the voice of fear and hide, or seek it out and face the shame or shadows. It's enough to set out to tame demons and watch them multiply instead. It's enough to be buffeted by the winds of change and not be blown over. I and you, all of us, more than enough. Sounds like taking refuge to me. So that's all I have to say. So as usual, I'm going to sing. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all. Good night. Have a good sleep. We'll see you all again soon.